Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here, and with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season three of the Shondaland series on Netflix, then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
On August 6, 1993, shots were fired in front of a bodega in East New York, Brooklyn. One young man named Ray Frazier survived, while his friend Devon Brown did not. Eventually, two alleged witnesses gave police a suspect, someone nicknamed Guns. On August 30th, a car was pulled over and two guns were found inside, along with a man who had an outstanding arrest warrant. His name was Frederick Willie Kearse, and his nickname was Guns. Even though Frederick claimed to have been in Boston on the day and time of the crime, he was identified by two alleged witnesses, and a gun from the car was said to have matched ballistics from the crime scene. But this is wrongful conviction. Wrongful conviction has always given voice to innocent people in prison, and now we're expanding that voice to you. Call us at 833-207-4666 and tell us how these stories make you feel and what you've done to help the cause, even if it's something as simple as telling a friend or sharing on social media. We've really appreciated hearing from our audience, so much so that we've included one of the messages at the end of this episode, so stick around for that. And if you have something to say, we definitely want to hear it. And you might just hear yourself in a future episode. Call us, 833-207-4666. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today's case comes from an era when wrongful convictions were just an everyday occurrence in the borough of Brooklyn, East New York specifically, the notorious 75th Precinct in New York City. And with us to tell it is the man himself, Frederick Willie Kearse, who lived through this nightmare. Frederick, I appreciate you being here. I know you know a lot of guys who've been on the show already, and we need to continue to paint this picture of what was going on in Brooklyn in the 90s. So thanks for being here and sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
And with him is his civil rights attorney, Mark Cannon of Beldock, Levine & Hoffman. Mark, I think it's your first time on the show, so welcome.
Thank you.
By the way, while we're on the subject of the 75th Precinct, this is not hyperbole to say they were one of the most corrupt in history. In fact, there's even a movie about them called The 7-5 that was released in 2014. So I encourage people to watch the movie to get some context on what was going on back then and why Frederick was, you know, doomed from the beginning.
That's exactly right. And it was all about closing cases back then. And you talk about the early 90s and the crack epidemic. But, you know, Michael Race, who was a detective sergeant at the precinct around that time, admitted that over the 750 murder investigations that he supervised at the 75th Precinct, only one was done correctly.
Incredible. I mean, they were playing by their own set of rules, to say the least, and framing somebody was nothing to them. So, Frederick, before you got hit by this tornado of the 75th Precinct. What was your life like? Did you grow up in Brooklyn?
Yes, I was born and raised in East New York, Brooklyn. Several years later, I moved to Bedford-Stuyvesant, the Marcy houses, and my family lived in East New York, so I used to always go and chill out with them over the summer and spend time with them over there. And I really played a lot of basketball and just tried to find my way through school. You know, I really didn't grab hold of the academic process when I was young for numerous reasons. I think one of the top ones was how terrible the public schools were and weren't able to reach me where I was at. Unfortunately, later on in life, while I was incarcerated, I found out that, you know, the way that I was so competitive in basketball that I was able to apply that with anything that I can do. So that later propelled me to go and earn my GED and go to Bard College and, you know, graduate from there. So
it's sad to think of what could have been had Frederick not come of age during the crack epidemic in a historically poor area of New York, where he was hustling in the streets, leading to a few related charges, which he escaped by going on the lam to Boston.
Yes, I had a few drug charges and a weapon charge. You know, this is where my level of thinking was. I was, you know, not understanding that the same energy I put into the streets and thinking negative, I could have did something positive. So that's how I was up in Massachusetts. And unfortunately, being caught up in crime can lead to being wrongfully convicted and accused of other things, you know, which is something I couldn't fathom because my mind didn't expand that far at the time. And I didn't understand the risk once you get into any type of criminal activity. So, you know, that's how the Massachusetts thing come into play. But it helped in the case because I had an alibi.
Frederick was in Boston on August 6, 1993, when a drive-by shooting occurred in East New York, Brooklyn. 911 calls reported a Buick Century that had been traveling north on Ashford Street and made a wide left turn onto Dumont Avenue, pulling up to a bodega on the northeast corner, and more than 10 shots were fired, striking two young men. Ray Frazier was hit in the legs and survived, while Devon Brown was fatally shot in the torso. And the vehicle finished the left turn, fleeing west on Dumont. EMTs responded and took the victims to Brookdale Hospital, where Devon was pronounced dead.
So police showed up pretty quickly, and they immediately started canvassing for witnesses. Unsurprisingly, even though this was during the daytime in a, you know, somewhat populated neighborhood, there were no witnesses. Nobody wanted to talk to the police, you know, because that's generally not something people did. They send officers to the hospital. They talk to Ray. Ray says he couldn't see who shot at him, has no idea, doesn't know why they wanted to shoot him. And they talk to two women who we now know, one woman who was Devon's girlfriend at the time, Yolanda Pondler, also known as Barbara Garth. She told the officers that she was at Devon's house, which was about a half block down from the corner of Ashford and Dumont. She heard shots fired and, you know, saw people running, and she saw the car turn the corner, but she didn't see anything. They talked to Ray's girlfriend, who's also at the hospital. She pretty much sees the same thing. The car turned the corner. It's a green car, and that's about the only information she's able to provide.
Another witness, Greg Maloney, had a similar initial account since he was also in front of Devon's house, 555 Ashford Street, which was about a football field's length north of the corner. So neither of these witnesses could have made a reliable ID from that distance, leaving the police with little to go on. Meanwhile, Devon's family and friends had their own ideas about who the shooter was.
One of the names that kept coming up was this person known as Guns, because Guns and Devon, supposedly they had known each other and been friendly at one point, but the relationship supposedly went sour, and that's what people suspected. So the police pick up the rumor that people think Guns did it, and Greg Maloney, he actually was probably pointed out to the police by members of Devon's family because people knew he was kind of a pushover. The police go to him. They ask him, do you know who Guns is? He's like, yeah, I know who Guns is. Did you see who did the shooting? No. And the cops tell him, well, if you saw the shooter, you saw Guns, because at that point, they were going to take the position that Guns was the person who did it, although even though they didn't have a witness. And they give him a story about why Guns is a bad person, and they think he's involved in other misconduct that's going on in the neighborhood, and, you know, they want to make an example of him, they want to get him off the street. They didn't have to hold anything specific over his head. They basically threatened that they would arrest him, and he would be deported, trying to pressure Greg into helping him. Greg eventually gives a statement, basically describes what he saw, but he places Guns as the shooter, even though he didn't actually see that.
Unfortunately, this important context around Greg Maloney, as well as the initial police reports from the interviews at the hospital with Barbara Garth, were not discovered until the reinvestigation of this case and Maloney's eventual recantation. But back in 1993, Greg Maloney and Barbara Garth were convinced to give statements identifying the shooter as a guy nicknamed Guns, which coincidentally was very similar to Frederick's nickname.
My name is Guns, right? G-U-N-C-E. It always got misinterpreted as Guns, but, you know, there was other people in the neighborhood also known as Guns. So, you know, that's what they used to call me. And I unfortunately never really corrected it as being Guns instead of Guns. So
where does Guns come from?
Well, you know, in the South, my grandmother gave me that name. So I never really asked her what it meant. You don't question grandma. You just go with the nickname and be thankful that she holds you in a special little nickname category.
While the police were focused on the Guns rumor, Frederick came back into town from Boston on August 30th to visit with family, traveling with three others in a white convertible with Massachusetts plates, and it appears that they were pulled over without any cause.
What I suspect is that they profiled the car, this convertible with Massachusetts plates, two women in the front, two guys in the back.
Unfortunately, two people were carrying weapons. I did not have no weapon, anything on me.
And so the two women, one of whom was a former parole officer who had the ability to have the gun on her, and this other woman, who I don't know, but, you know, they pulled the car over. There's people with guns on it, so.
So they ran everyone's IDs, which revealed Frederick's outstanding arrest warrant.
When he's being brought to the precinct, there's another woman there, Darlene Cook. She recognizes Frederick and says, "Hey, Guns." And when she did that, obviously the detectives realized this is the person who they'd been hearing about, the name that they'd been looking for.
And since it appears that this stop and search was done without cause, but had turned up these weapons and an arrest warrant, the police were in a little bit of a civil rights pickle.
I think they profiled the car, they stopped it, and then created the justification afterwards. They got this person, Darlene Cook, to say, "This convertible with Massachusetts plates pointed a gun at me and threatened me." That's what I suspect.
It's quite strange that charges related to those allegations from Darlene Cook never materialized. However, Frederick was already facing plenty, starting with the prior charges that he'd evaded by moving to Boston.
I take full responsibility for my actions dealing with that. I ended up getting sentenced to 1 to 3 year sentences running consecutively, which was 2 to 6 years. As far as in this case, I had no idea that I was even a suspect until I got to the precinct. You know, then they put me in a lineup and told me everything.
By this time, police had found another witness named Carmen Tirado, who, unlike Barbara Garth and Greg Maloney, had said that she could reliably identify the shooter. Yet, during this lineup, Tirado identified someone else, while Garth and Maloney ID'd Frederick, who was now facing murder and attempted murder, while serving 2 to 6 years for his priors.
So I ended up going back and forth from Rikers back upstate, fighting the murder charge here from 93 to 1995. Like, every time if they postpone my court date for, like, any more than 2 weeks, they would send me back upstate, and I'd be going back and forth. You know, I had no real communication with my attorney. You know, he would not come visit me. I felt like I would get off only because I know I didn't do it. That's all that was on my mind. You know, it was so much violence. Multiple people were getting killed and stabbed on Rikers Island. I've seen so many horrific situations myself. And to add, I did get cut on Rikers Island, too. Be honest, I don't know how I got through it.
Freedom Agenda is a proud sponsor of this episode of Wrongful Conviction. Freedom Agenda is led by people directly impacted by incarceration, and they're organizing to get Mayor Eric Adams to follow the law and shut down Rikers Island. Right now, thousands of people are awaiting trial there in life-threatening conditions. Freedom Agenda is committed to creating a safer and more just city by winning investments in long-neglected communities, protecting the rights of people involved in the criminal legal system, and ending the cycle of violence that Rikers perpetuates. To learn more about the campaign to close Rikers and to sign up for Freedom Agenda's mailing list, go to campaigntoclosericers.org/get involved or follow at Freedom Agenda NY on social media.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie.
He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
While communication was strained with his assigned counsel, Stephen Chaikin, they were able to find one of his roommates outside Boston to testify on his behalf at trial in 1995.
Pierce had an alibi witness, a woman he was living with. It was actually Springfield, Massachusetts at the time. She didn't remember the exact day, but testified how they lived together and usually had dinner together during that time.
It was a lot of things that couldn't be recalled from her with the timings and all that I think got misconstrued and made it a little bit more harder for the jury and the court to believe that I was not actually in New York when this crime happened. That's basically all I had was the alibi, and I thought that's really all I needed.
But that was not enough to counteract other evidence against him.
The state presented Barbara Garth and Greg Maloney, whose testimonies were a stark departure from their initial statements in which they could not make an ID. But now they were both certain that Frederick was the shooter.
Greg described this car slowly coming down Ashford and around Dumont, where somebody came out of the car and started shooting, whereas Barbara Garth had a much more dramatic story, and she claimed she saw Kearse driving the car before the shooting, and then she claimed she was coming down Dumont, approaching Devon and Ray as they came out of this bodega, and she was waving to them, and all of a sudden, she sees this car with Kearse in it, comes around and actually runs into Ray. She says it knocks him onto the sidewalk, and then she says Kearse comes out and starts shooting at Devon and Ray before taking off. And then she claims she runs to Devon and, you know, says, I love you. And he says, I love you. And he squeezes her hand and his eyes roll over.
Barbara Garth also testified that even though she allegedly already knew it was Frederick while Devon Brown was dying in her arms, she claimed to have asked him if he knew who had shot him, quote, to see if he would lie, end quote. Which sounds just like cop logic to establish an ID untainted by suggestion, not the logic of a soon-to-be grief-stricken girlfriend. Either way, Barbara Garth was completely absent from Greg Maloney's version of events, which is a jarring inconsistency.
Even though they had these inconsistent stories, they also had the gun that was recovered from the woman who was driving the car that Kearse got picked up in a month later, August 30th. It's a ballistics expert testified that he examined the ballistics evidence, the ammunition casings recovered from the crime scene, compared to two bullets shot out of the gun recovered from this woman who was driving the car that Kearse was in on August 30th, and they said it's the same gun. And Kearse's defense counsel, he didn't challenge that claim.
You can listen to our coverage of ballistics evidence on Wrongful Conviction Junk Science, in which you'll find that ballistics analysis can really only be useful in ruling out a weapon, but you cannot identify a weapon to the exclusion of all others. That's exactly what was done here.
The NYPD ballistics expert testified that scientifically it was a perfect match and that that's impossible. My impression is that the defense counsel didn't even look at the ballistics evidence. The only thing he did to challenge it was to say, well, maybe the bullets were there before the shooting, which, of course, is not a strong defense.
And the jury goes out. How long did they deliberate for?
Wow. I think for like a day and a half, because I had to come back and it was a lot of readbacks with them asking for clarification with certain contradictions that was with the witnesses' statements.
And by the way, more power to them, because after two or three weeks of a bunch of bullshit, it wouldn't have been surprising to me if you would have said they deliberated for an hour, came back and said guilty, and now we're going home. But that's not what they did. So they had questions, they had doubts, but ultimately they sentenced you to 20 years to life for the murder, 8 1/3 years to 25 for attempted murder, 5 to 15 for the possession of the weapon, and 2 1/3 to 7 for the assault, all to be served consecutively to the 20 to life.
You know, my family was in the courtroom when they came back with the guilty verdict, and I can still hear my sister screaming inside the courtroom. And to me, everything seemed like the courtroom just was shrinking. You know, I just wanted to get out of there. It felt like everything was collapsing on me, and I couldn't really believe it. That's just something that continuously, to this day, I go through as I think about those moments.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie.
He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I had a fourth and fifth grade reading level at the time, so that was very hard for me, and I think kind of maybe prolonged my stay in prison, because after I did get educated, I put my bunk, so to speak, inside the law library and started studying and writing everybody in the country for assistance. So,
wait, you put your bunk inside the law library? I never heard that before.
You know, that's something we used to say, like you live in a law library when you're trying to get some type of resolve. So I just was there every day in so many ways. I was just trying to say that.
So somebody must have helped you, because you come in there, you know, you have fourth, fifth grade reading level. Did you have a mentor in there who was able to, you know, help you persevere and find a way out of this mess?
Yes, I had quite a few people that, and I used to work in a mess hall, so it was this brother there by the name of Alameen, and he was very good at the law, and he used to help me a lot, and I think that's what he taught me most, just to write and how to write the course, FOIA requests or whatever, try to get some type of correspondence going on with the attorney, Mr. Chaykin, that never wrote me back in the whole 28 years. But yes, I had a lot of help in that regard. But the most help I got was just understand that I didn't do the crime and that I was not going to stop until I got some type of answers. Fortunately, I ended up in a prison, Coxsackie Correction Facility. And again, the name Gunn sort of was my gift at this point, because someone was in a few cells down from me. They heard the name, and then they were the porter on the block and came out and started asking me who I am, where I'm from. And long story short, that person knew the witness that testified against me.
And this man's name is Gavin Johnson.
So Gavin Johnson lived a couple houses down from Devon Brown, and he was actually at home on Ashford Street at the time of the murders. He recalled hearing the shooting and then running outside and running up the street to see what happened and seeing that Devon got shot. So when he came across Frederick in Coxsackie, he was shocked to find out that one of the witnesses who testified against him was Greg Maloney, because he knew that Greg Maloney had never said anything about knowing who the murderer was of Devon Brown.
And after that, you know, he just was really willing to try to get Maloney to talk to my lawyer. And
first, well, the witness, Greg Maloney, didn't want to get in trouble himself and say, you know, I perjured myself at trial, and he wanted to wait for the statute of limitations to run out. When that finally happened and Frederick finally got Greg to give him a statement in 2000, he immediately gets, I think it was a legal aid lawyer involved to try to help him with the 440. And that whole process ends up taking several more years while the lawyer's trying to develop a case. And they don't think this one recantation is enough. They think they need the other witness to recant as well. It's not till 2007 that Frederick uses his recantation in one of his pro se 440s. The judge is like, well, why did you take so long? This is incredible, and just throws it out.
They rejected my motion. From then on, I just started writing law clinics and actual innocent projects and Mr. Myron Beldock, Ronald Cuby. I mean, I wrote everybody and their mother trying to act for some help. Then at 2015, I was fortunate to write, may he rest in peace, Mr. Myron Beldock, based on another case, People versus Wagstaff, that he did that also involved the 75th Precinct, because I knew that he was skilled with the 75th Precinct and knew about their tricks of making it appear as if witnesses were at crime scenes and were not.
And Myron Beldock was, of course, one of the named partners from Mark's firm, Beldock, Levine, and Hoffman. And you can hear more about his work in our interview with Everett and Wagstaff that will be linked in the episode description.
you know, Myron Beldock actually read every letter he got from a prisoner. At the end of his life, that was like one of his biggest concerns, is that, you know, the letters from prisoners were piling up in his mailbox. But he read Frederick's letter, so he gave the case to another lawyer, Keith Schepansky, who started investigating it. He found another witness who was actually Gavin Johnson's brother, Donald, who was a catty corner, I think, to where the bodega that Devon and Ray came out of at the time the murder took place. And so he witnessed it. And he couldn't identify who did the murder, but he knows that Greg was not on the opposite corner at the time of the shooting. And he also knows that Barbara Garth was not across the street on Dumont Avenue approaching the corner at the time of the shooting. He knows those people were down the block because he had just come from down the block.
And so this became the foundation of a new 440 motion, along with the false expert ballistics testimony.
By the time the case came to me, I hired an expert to point out the problems with the ballistic evidence used to convict Frederick. But we needed more to knock out the other witness. Barbara Garth, we were never able to find, but there are two other important pieces of evidence that we were able to get through FOIL requests. First, the DD-5s from the hospital. Frederick got the file from his lawyer, and he only had redacted copies that didn't identify who it was that the police interviewed at the hospital. And I thought one of them had to be Barbara Garth, but I was able to finally get the file from the NYPD. They gave me an unredacted copy that showed that Barbara Garth was the person saying right after the shooting that she was in front of 555 Ashford Street when the shooting took place, not right near the corner of the shooting, which is what she testified to. So that's a significant Brady violation because she was giving false testimony. There's one other important piece of information we're still actually putting the finishing touches on, but basically there was this practice that district attorney's offices were engaging in. If a witness wasn't cooperating, they would get a material witness warrant. Normally, you're supposed to bring in the witness before a judge and so they can tell the judge why they didn't want to testify, and either they'll hold them or they won't. But they did get a material warrant for Barbara Garth to testify against Frederick at trial, and they told the judge it was a misunderstanding. She was actually happy to testify. Therefore, you can just vacate the warrant. And she testified at trial, but we're just getting the evidence to bear this out. We believe that they held her at a hotel under lock and key until she provided the testimony that they wanted, and then she was released. So that piece of information, combined with the DD-5 showing she testified falsely about where she was, knocks out her as a witness. Then it resuscitates the reliability of Greg Maloney recantation, which is also resuscitated by Don Johnson's testimony. And then we have the expert who will testify about the ballistics evidence. That gives us, I think, a very strong case to bring to the conviction integrity unit.
So despite debunking the state's case, both alleged eyewitnesses and the junk science, Frederick has not been exonerated. Rather, after serving 28 years and 4 months, he went in front of the parole board for the very first time in early 2021.
I was denied, actually, as a result of the opposition letter that was written years ago by former District Attorney Charles Hines. He had implemented that policy where they will write an opposition letter when you get convicted and sentenced, and 30 years later, they still can use that opposition letter against you. However, again, me reading and studying the law and trying to make a case for myself, I learned that current District Attorney Eric Gonzalez put together a memo that states that he's no longer using those opposition letters that were written decades ago.
I have to give credit to this organization called the Parole Prep Project, who helped Frederick with his parole application. And then they went to the Kings County District Attorney's office, explained Frederick's situation, how he got convicted at a young age, drug crime, etc. And they got the district attorney to write a letter on Frederick's behalf saying that they would not oppose him being released on parole because he'd been in jail so long from a young age for a drug crime. And I think that was like a major piece of why he was able to get parole without admitting wrongdoing.
6 months later, I got released in December 2021. Honestly, it was great, you know, because I had a family to come home to. Thankfully, my mom is still alive. She's 81. You know, I'm with her now in a home. You know, I missed all those years of my daughter's life. She's 33 now. So the freedom, of course, is great. You know, I have the chance to do for myself and be responsible and show my parents and my family that I'm not this convicted killer that, you know, I was portrayed to be. And You know, the whole parole process is very difficult because they come up to your house 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, guns out, and the whole neighborhood know that you're on parole. And then I have to report there, which is similar to going back in prison. You know, the whole process just keeps reoccurring and you got to experience it all over again. And of course, when I first got home, I got denied Department of Education job as a result of my criminal record, despite, you know, I had a degree. So, you know, it's been very hard. But again, Parole Preparation Project has supported me. Currently, I'm an employee at the Parole Preparation Project. You know, I'm a co-founder of my archive-based creative art program with them. So, you know, they've been very instrumental in helping me prepare for the parole board, in addition to transitioning out here, you know, to take care of myself. So it's been hard, but I am very fortunate when you look at so many others that don't have the opportunities that I have. It's very difficult, and I just hope that I have a day where I could get some justice due to all this work I put in and all the people that supported me. And, you know, just prove my innocence. I just really pray that it's something, some resolve that I can get.
With how thoroughly this case has been dismantled, the Brooklyn DA's office will surely find it difficult to say that this conviction has any integrity. But in the meantime, we're going to link to your work with the Archive-Based Creative Arts Project, as well as the Parole Prep Project, and perhaps our audience will be moved to get involved. And with that, we're going to go to closing arguments. Mark and Frederick, thank you so much for being here. And I'm now going to turn my microphone off and kick back in my chair and just listen to anything else you want to share. So, Mark, you start it off and then just hand the mic off to Frederick and he'll take us off into the sunset.
The thing that's so striking about this case is that Willie should never have been convicted. And a large part of why he did get wrongfully convicted and stayed in jail for the 28 years is because he never got the representation he should have, and it just seemed like one disservice after another until finally when he came up for parole, he had these law school volunteers take up his cause and actually zealously work to help get him released on parole. And I think that was the first time where the system started working for him, and I will hopefully get the system to do the right thing and vacate his conviction. And I'm also, I guess, want to say how impressed I am with Frederick and with the great attitude he maintains, despite what he's been through. You know, whenever I called him when he was on the inside, I was just always just really taken with that the system hadn't broken him and that he had such a hope and a reverence for life and that he faces great adversity and comes out like an even stronger, better person and is helping others. So that's really a testament to Frederick's character.
Thank you, Mark. You know, I understand my history. I understand what Black people have went through in this country. So, you know, I understand it's not really personal. You know, it's systemic. And only way to address it is having opportunities like you're giving me now. You know, start making this information known and telling our stories, right? A lot happened to me in that place, you know, that I probably am still trying to understand, you know, far as trauma-wise. I can stay here all day and, you know, express the pains that happened to me, but that isn't going to get me nowhere. I have to stay level-minded, focused, and realize that it's a bigger issue going on with the whole system, and it's not just me. I've stood on a premise of I did not do this crime, and so many people I was with went through the same thing. I understand it. You know, I understand it from a different lens, from a historical perspective, and from a systemic perspective to this day. It's truly sad for the racial disparity to be so bad with people of color and being wrongfully convicted. And I don't like to just look at it like everything is bad. This is why I maintain my hope. This is why I refuse to let a few people that was in the system that did me wrong just dominate the whole system and look at it like, you know, everything and everyone is bad. I have to keep a level mind to expose the system as much as I can. Here's what needs to be done. And use the things that exactly happened to me inside that trial and the system that are still going on in the system today that I would like to set a precedent with. So again, thank you so much for this opportunity. I look forward to doing whatever I can to continue to expose this system.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at @itsjasonflom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1. We've been hearing some incredible feedback from our listeners, and today I want to share one of the testimonials that we got on our hotline, so to speak. And please call us. We'd love to hear from you as well. 833-207-4666. It means so much to me. Check it out for yourself.
Hi, my name is Jessica DeLiberto. Listening to Wrongful Conviction really made a big impact on my life because I have been a really big true crime addict, like most people, for a long time. But Wrongful Conviction really opened my eyes to the great injustices that happen within our criminal justice system. 2 years ago, I started grad school to get my master's in criminology, and I completed my capstone on the influences of junk science and false expert testimony on wrongful convictions, which was hugely inspired by this podcast. I really hope to be able to use my degree to be able to work on wrongful convictions in the future and make an impact. Thank you so much for everything that you guys do.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here, and with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix, then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.